BFFT. From the Pac West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Morgan State is telling me if we want Jaden Robinson, we can have Jaden Robinson all year. He wants to do it. This question brought to you by Jamba. Life is better blended. Because Jamba sponsors that weekly segment where we interview an Oregon State athlete or an Oregon athlete. And so Jaden Robinson potentially making the Oregon State appearance. Tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT. Tell me if you support Jaden Robinson as the athlete who should participate in our weekly interview brought to you by Jamba.
Well, that was the question we should have asked him, is what's your Jamba flavor? What's your go-to?
I'm going to text him right now. I'm going to ask him, what is your go-to Jamba?
And that might decide the answer. You know, if it's a good answer.
Yeah.
That's plus points.
Oh, let's see what he says. Coming up later this hour, Kelly Graves. You'll hear my interview with Graves, University of Oregon women's basketball coach. He's in Paris. I don't know why I see him with one of those French hats on and a striped shirt. And he's eating a croissant. Or a croissant, if you're not in Paris. We'll find out more about Kelly Graves' journey to France coming up. And you'll hear him from Paris. It's kind of nice to know somebody who's there, you know? So technology today, very easy for him. I texted with him. He said, I'd love to come on. I said, great, let's do this. By the way, what time is it when we, like 4 o'clock, 4:20? What time would it be in Paris around that hour? And of course, for people who know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. It's 1:02 in the morning now in Paris. So they're just getting going. They're just getting going in France. But I said to Kelly Graves, why don't we tape this around like 1 p.m., which is 10 p.m. their time. So we taped the interview right before the show, and then I wrote a column about Teresa Gold, the Pac-12 commissioner, and then I went right into the show. So it's been a lively Friday afternoon. I thought it would be a relatively slow Friday afternoon, but it's been very lively, and we'll see how that goes. I got a question, too, that came up in our household. Are you a soccer guy, Steven, at all?
I would say no.
Okay, I'm not really a soccer guy.
I would say not really, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched soccer. I've been to soccer matches. I've been to Timber matches. I've been to Olympic soccer matches.
I think is cool. Like, you know, like the FIBA or the Copa FIFA? America. Sorry, yeah, Copa America was on. Like, those are fun. The World Cups are fun, but outside of that, fine.
So today, a interesting question came up in our household because our youngest daughter has played more soccer than anybody in the family. Any of the other two sisters. The youngest daughter likes the game. She has fun. She's decent at it. She wants to play. So she's playing on this team that is having a big tournament this weekend. A bunch of kids are playing soccer. And she went to go get her jersey, and came time for her to pick a number. And soccer numbers, historically, there's a history behind the soccer numbers, but there's a little bit... Soccer numbers are a little, I don't want to say persnickety, but the number one usually goes to a goalie because you have to have a goalkeeper, and it's the first person that's listed on the lineup card. So goalkeepers have traditionally wore the number one. Your attacking players traditionally wear numbers 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Lionel Messi wears 10. For example, there are exceptions to this, but those numbers, much like in basketball, 23, Michael Jordan, later LeBron, became a coveted number. 8, Kobe, became a coveted number. What else in basketball? Coveted numbers. 32, Magic.
Yeah, Magic. It's Jordan, it's Kobe now, and then, so yeah, it's 23, 24, kind of the go-tos right now.
There you go. And LeBron, does LeBron not get credit for wearing 23 or what?
I mean, kind of, but I think it's mostly MJ, right?
You're such a hater. but in soccer, there's a little bit, like, when you're playing upper levels of soccer, the jersey numbers, you'll tend to notice, like, number 9 becomes, like, a, you know, your center midfielder, it's a striker number, you know, that's a scorer. But my kid is, she's a forward, but she wanted the number 1. And I have always traditionally looked at the number 1 and thought, you know, takes a lot of confidence to wear the number 1. But she wanted to wear the number 1, and I was like, I don't know, is that supposed to be the goalie on your team? Like, isn't, you know? So I was kind of thinking about that, and I reached out to John Strong, the voice of American soccer. And I said, hey, if she takes the number 1, is that supposed to go to the goalie or whatever? And he's like, she's 8. Unless the coach has come up in 1950s Germany, they can wear any number. And so I would have went for like a 42 or a 99, something different. But she's out there running around today as the number 1 on her team. And it so happens, I told her this too, that her picture and her number are the same. She's very skinny. And so she's a number 1, and she looks like a number 1 when she's out there. So there she is. Did you know that about soccer numbers? That the goalkeeper, like if you look at the U.S. women's national team in the Olympics right now, the goalkeeper on the women's team wears number 1.
I can't say that I would know that, but I would have probably guessed it because, I mean, it is for basketball and for baseball and for football. They all kind of have their own designated alleys.
I didn't know that, though. I didn't know that until I looked it up. I had to look it up.
But if you had to guess, would you have guessed? Because like in baseball, I mean, 18 is first base.
I wouldn't have. But then you know what I found out when I started going down the rabbit hole is, you know, when you think about baseball numbers, some of the great baseball numbers of all time, historically, you think about this. Babe Ruth wore the number 3. He was the 3 hitter for the Yankees. It was the number 3 was by his name in the lineup. And so Babe Ruth wore 3, Lou Gehrig wore 4. That's why they wore the number 3 and the number 4. And I didn't really realize that either until I started researching, you know, the lineup and the numbers. And it was interesting to me to kind of see, like, oh yeah, like the Yankees lineup that featured Ruth and Gehrig, you basically had Ruth wearing 3 and you had Gehrig wearing 4.
Well, when you played, was the number super important to you?
It was, I was a big, like, I liked Jackie Robinson and I liked Ted Williams. And so if I was on a team where I could get any number, I would always, whether it was football or baseball or whatever, I would try to get 42. And then if I couldn't, I would try to get 9 for Ted Williams. Because that was the other number. And 9 wasn't like a real popular number. People wanted 8. People wanted 1. People wanted 2, 6. You know, but I don't know. Was number big for you in basketball? What'd you wear?
It was not a big one for me. I always wanted to be 50 because I always thought it was cool, like when a guard would wear 50. I can only think of one. That was Eddie House back in the day. He used to wear number 50. I always thought it looked really cool. And I mean, I just wanted to be different. Like you said, nobody's 50 and out there. But I was numerous different numbers. High school, I want to say I was like 32. And then in college, I was like 10 and 12 and 34 at the same time in like really? 4 years. Yeah. So numbers not a big deal for me.
There you go. Well, there we have it. Let's play some Punch It.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio,
presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Hey, Thamel. ESPN. Talking about the playoff. How will the playoff affect the regular season? How will it affect teams? Thamel trying to put a finger on it. Punch it.
And this is part of the gift that we don't know what's in and we don't know what's unwrapped is, like, when do you stop being a contender when you don't really have any, like, knowledge of how the playoff is going to unfold? And I think, too, the league's growing the way they are. We have no idea how the committee is going to judge these teams, right? This many lost SEC team versus this many lost Big 12. So I feel like until November 1st, and I'm just absolutely making this up off the top of my head, there will be 30 teams, you could say, that are in contention.
I think it's too many. I think he's casting too broad a net for November 1st. But I think there will be maybe 20 that are in contention at that point, including the group of fives, which will have a couple of teams that aren't ranked in there. But I think it's going to come down to like the top 15 or 18 teams really thinking they're jockeying for position. Couple on the outside looking in. I think 30 is too many. Steven, you?
Yeah, I think 30 is too many. I also think that as time goes by, we're going to figure out that the number 11 seed or the number 10 seed isn't necessarily a true contender. Right, like they'll get into the playoffs, so technically they have a chance to win the national title. But I do think when we get to the top four, top five teams, it's going to be a different tier than 6 through 10 in a lot of years. So I think there's going to be a lot of times where, yeah, a team gets in at number 10 or 11, but they're not really true contenders. Maybe they get an upset. Maybe they can upset one of these top teams. But I think when we get closer to it, the list will dwindle down to, you know, 15, 20 teams, and we'll figure out who's really fighting. You know, we're going to argue 13 and 14. We're not going to be fighting over who number 20 is.
We're also going to be faced with the group of five champion. Is it a ranked team? Can it be anything other than the 12 seed? Going to have to be ranked above 12 in the CFP rankings to get in there. But I'm really curious to see how that plays out. I also am interested in how many teams the Big Ten and how many teams the SEC are going to get in the first year, 12-team playoff. Will they get three? Will someone get four? Keep an eye on that. Lincoln Riley at USC. USC officially a member of the Big Ten Conference as of midnight. Lincoln Riley talking about the dawn of an era. Punch it.
Well, it's a massive change. It is. I think we'll all understand like how big of a change it is as time goes on, because you know, college football, as we all know, has changed in so many ways. But when this big of a combination, you take a team that has historically played the majority of their games, you know, out west, and now all of a sudden you're going to bring in all of these different matchups. You're going to have different rivalries that grow because of this. You know, the history is going to be changed forever, and you'll look back and say this was the day that it all started.
Is this the day that it all started, though? I mean, really? I mean, I think if you really start to go back, you start to unwind it, you start to find that this kind of the mechanisms were in place and were slowly moving 5-6 years ago. Pat Chun at Washington tried to summarize why this is important for his school, Huskies, in the Big Ten. Punch it.
Well, it's a momentous day, and it's a day that you know, when you think about where college athletics is at, where the Big Ten is relative to prominence, not only as a college entity, but as a global brand, and where Washington is in terms of a institution and a global brand. It's, you know, we're honored to be a part of the Big Ten Conference. We're excited about what's on the horizon, but also excited just to be, I've told a lot of people when you walk around our campus and you get the sense of what Washington is, you know, the type of institution we are. I mean, we are a Big Ten school, and you know, this is where we're supposed to be, and it's where we feel like we can impact our young people the best by putting them on the biggest stage possible, and that's the Big Ten Conference.
It's so weird to hear Chun talking like that after he was talking very differently at Washington State about what happened to the Pac-12. I think he's saying what he needs to say, and he's speaking largely to his own constituents, and that's what people do. Still, it's kind of weird. Dana Altman at Oregon, they're in the Big Ten in men's basketball. What's that going to be like? Punch it.
Well, first of all, you know, for basketball, great venues. Great coaches. You know, you look around and a lot of those guys have been at those institutions a long time and have had a great deal of success. So competition will be great. The environments will be great.
I'm not convinced that it's going to be a tougher conference for him. He won't have Arizona to deal with. He won't have UCLA to deal with. There's still challenges in the Big Ten. Certainly Purdue was fantastic a year ago.
But when you say the environments are going to be tougher, like the road games are going to be, like when you go to Illinois, that is a tough game. When you go to, a Washington who has had some good teams, it's not necessarily a super tough game.
No.
Environment-wise.
Yeah, but There were some bad environments in the Pac-12 that weren't necessarily tough places to play and win. And not every place in the Big Ten is tough, Steven. I've covered that conference. You can go to Northwestern. You can go to Minnesota. You go play at Rutgers.
Historically had a tough basketball environment. And they got the number one recruit coming in.
We'll see. I only speak for Iowa, Illinois, Purdue, Indiana. Those are tough places to play.
You think Oregon can get to the NCAA tournament next season?
Yes. But I think it has more to do with the fact that they've got a really good guard in Jackson Shellstead who's going to carry him there. I don't care where they're playing. I think he's that good. And, I don't love some of what's going on with Oregon's roster. I'm trying to figure out, how do they replace Enfali Dante? And, are the kids that Dana Altman's going to bring in going to be team guys? But Jackson Shellstead is so good, he's above that. I think he carries them there regardless. Let's talk about Bo Nix. Diana Russini of The Athletic saying that Bo Nix is checking all the boxes in Denver's preseason camp. Punch it.
Bo Nix has had a really good camp so far. The difficulty from going from playing college, you know better than anyone, to going to the NFL, it's a substantial step that you need to take. But the fact that he is able to get in and out of the huddle without any issues. Yeah. The offensive line isn't getting called for penalties, things that we heard so much of last year, but I'm hearing out of Denver, this stuff is already getting cleaned up with a rookie quarterback. In terms of what Bo Nix has shown them there, they know that they've got something that they can build off.
Well, Bo Nix is like 30 years old. That's part of this, right? He started 60 games in college. He's got some experience. He's seen some stuff. He can get you in and out of the huddle. This is not, this isn't a rookie like rookies used to be in the NFL. Because things that rookies used to be in the NFL were rookies were younger and less experienced. And what do we say? We always said, it takes them 2 or 3 years. They need more reps. But I would argue that it's the same logic that the 49ers benefited from. Brock Purdy, Iowa State. Steven, he started 48 games in college. So when Brock Purdy was thrown in there, this wasn't his, first situation. Sure, it was the NFL. Yes, it moved faster. Yes, it was a different offense. But he came in after sitting behind Jimmy Garoppolo and after having 48 starts in college and staying in college for 5 years. Bo Nix had longer than that at Oregon, 60-plus starts, NCAA record, 61 starts,
but
multiple schools. It's a huge advantage.
It is, but should we be super excited that he's just getting the team in and out of huddles without getting penalties? I don't know. Is he making good throws down the field? Is he making good decisions on the field? All the stuff I hear about Bo Nix is how good he is off the field, and we knew that's how it would be. The guy works hard. The guy has a great memory. He, one of the smartest guys in the game. But sometimes that only gets you so far, especially in the NFL or at the top levels. He has to prove he can do it with his arm, with his legs, with his brain during the play. Great. You can get the guys in and out of huddle. They're not doing false starts. Awesome. Can you make a throw on 3rd and 8 up in Seattle week 1 with a guy in your face? That's what I need to see.
Yes, but it's the kind of stuff that reporters watching a couple of days of training camp are being told, right? And they're saying, he's getting us in and out of the huddle. It's not a big deal. But I think it's basically they're just saying he has command, he's confident, he's got some poise. He's acting like a veteran, like he knows what he's doing. And I think that is some valuable stuff. Canada's 3-0 in the Olympics in basketball. Brian Windhorst says, do not sleep on Canada. It's not a hockey town anymore. Punch it.
Well, they play a game that really matches the way Team USA plays. They can play small. They have wing defenders, which is what you need against Team USA. They can switch 1 through 5. They obviously are not going to have any fear about going up against the Americans, who they are, their peers.
What do you think about Canada? Not a hockey town, not a hockey country, Is Canada a basketball country, Stephen?
They are. I have a bet on Canada to win the gold medal already. I bet that before it. I think that they're the second best team in the world behind USA. I think
what
USA.
What do you like about them? What do you like about Canada?
Their guard play is elite. They have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and then they also have guys that get out and guard. Dylan Brooks, Lou Dort, RJ Barrett. Like, those are guys that get out in the NBA and can guard those players. The problem they have, though, is they don't have great bigs, and USA... If they are struggling, which I think they will, Canada's going to be an elite defensive team. They can get them on the offensive rebounds, and that's where Canada struggles, is when they face big guys that can rebound. The game against Spain today, Spain was pushing them around, so that's the one weakness they have. But I think if you're going to go up and they're going to challenge them, you know Dylan Brooks is going to get in people's face. That makes me believe that America's going to say, okay, we're going to play some hero ball. We're going to go one-on-one ISO, and that's exactly what Canada's going to want you to do. They want to go one-on-one with you, offense versus their elite defense. I think that's the way they can get them. I hope that's the gold medal game. It'll be a great game between those two. I think USA should win, but the value in Canada was like 10-1, something like that. I think that was too much. I think Canada's actually a really good team, and I think they are going to win the gold medal.
There's an issue that Steve Kerr is having, and that he's being criticized for his starting lineups. He has mostly started Steph Curry, LeBron, Joel Embiid, Devin Booker, Drew Holiday. But he has featured lineups that had Jason Tatum, Anthony Edwards as starters. LeBron alongside Devin Booker one day, alongside Jason Tatum and Anthony Edwards another day. Anthony Davis had a start. Do egos get in the way at some point, or are these guys willing to be like the redeem team in 2008 that came back with a vengeance, with really Kobe leading the way, saying we need to put all of this behind us? I don't know if they have that guy like Kobe who's going to rally everybody together and be like, hey, it doesn't matter who's starting. We need to play. What do you think?
No, I agree with you, and I think that's what Canada has. Canada has Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Like, that is their guy, and he's the leader that everyone else follows. My fear with USA is when it comes down to the end of the game and a close game, it's going to be straight ISO ball. It's going to give me the ball, get out of my way, whether that's LeBron or Jason Tatum or Anthony Edwards. And we've seen in the past that doesn't work. Like, the world is too good now to just say, okay, here's our best versus your best. We're going to beat you one-on-one. It has to be a team game, and we've seen when USA is playing really well, they're moving the ball around. They're playing together as a team. I think that this type of team that they have right now for America is going to fall into the isolation trap. And that's where I worry about them against Canada. So, yeah, you're right. Unless they get out to a big lead and it doesn't matter, if it's a close game at the end of the game, I think that's where USA may struggle, actually.
I think you are onto something there that is worth talking about. Also, we're talking about the new kickoff rule in the NFL. It was on full display last night. First exhibition preseason game of the year. Looked very weird. Jason Kelce talking about it.
This play has been made obsolete in the past few years.
It became basically a mindless exercise.
It was a ceremony. Oh, here's the opening kickoff ceremony, rundown, 60 yards for no reason.
Commercial.
And now all of a sudden it's going to mean something. The game is better when special teams play a factor, when it makes a difference. And all those guys that put in that hard work get to go out there and actually execute something.
New kickoff rules. It makes the kickoff more relevant, but Steven, I am watching like video of this overhauled kickoff. It looks like the XFL to me.
It's weird. It is weird for sure. I don't know that I like the look of it. I think we'll get used to it as time goes on. But to that point, Jason Kelce's point, there was only one touchback last night. There was a lot of actual action on the kickoff. And I do think that there could be a chance that special team coordinators aren't necessarily throwing out their haymakers in the preseason, right?
True.
Like, they may be drawing something up ready for the regular season. We may see, some type of play out of this. Maybe, at the end of games, if teams are down by 6 points or 3 points, they need to get good field position. Maybe they throw a Justin Jefferson back there or a Tyreek Hill. And when they usually don't return kicks, I think this has potential to be really good. But you're right. It looked really weird, really clunky in the first game. But again, Hall of Fame game, can only take the one game sample size. But I think eventually we'll end up liking this rule.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. We'll see. It's going to result in fewer injuries, but obviously new strategy will come from it. But I looked at it and I was like, I have not seen this before. This looks like me and the two youngest daughters lining up the electric football players in a weird formation.
Yeah, it's like us playing in the backyard or something. Yes. Like, hey, you know what? We'll line up here and try to get by me.
This doesn't work. Where's the, why isn't everybody lined up in a line running full blast towards each other? All right, you're going to hear my interview with Kelly Graves. He's in Paris. He was in a good mood. Oregon women's basketball coach talked about recruiting from another country and more. Leave it here. Summer is here.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, the Olympics are on, which only means like or what emotion you have when you hear that. But I think about 1980 and the Olympic hockey team. Do you believe in miracles? I think about 1984, 88, 92. I think in four-year increments when I hear that song. But our next guest or the next interview you're going to hear, Kelly Graves, is the women's basketball coach at the University of Oregon. And Graves joined me for an interview that I'm going to air now. Kelly Graves in Paris. Here's how our conversation went. 10 p.m. his time, 1 p.m. my time today. Here is the Ducks women's basketball coach giving us a little bit of flavor. I like this. That he was willing to check in. We are interrupting Kelly Graves in the late evening in France. He is joining us from the site of the Olympics. Give us an idea. Set the scene for us, Coach. Where are you and what's it like?
Well, first of all, you say it's late. It's 10 p.m. People in Paris are just kind of starting to go out.
Okay.
It's been a lot of fun. It's been crazy. It was a tough travel to get here. But sure has been worth it. And it's electric. You can just kind of feel it everywhere you go. The people here are really into it.
When you get into the airport and you're kind of looking around, I mean, how soon does it hit you that there's an Olympics going on?
Well, you see some signs and there's extra greeters. Now, that being said, I didn't get in until about 2 a.m. So it wasn't all that electric in the airport. It was a tough day. My flight was canceled in London. I spent 12 hours in the London airport. I was supposed to fly into Brussels because I figured it would be easier and it's not far and take the train and the whole bit. And that flight was canceled, so they put me on a late one to Paris, and that was delayed. And I'm sitting in the middle because there was only like two seats left, and but I got here and you get to the hotel and it's still afternoon Portland in time, and so I wasn't ready to go to bed. It takes a while. Anybody who travels knows what I'm talking about, but extra melatonin and some sleep aids, and I knocked myself out and had a great day at the 3-on-3. That was a thrill. What a great venue.
Yeah, give me an idea. I've watched a little bit of that yesterday on TV, and it looked pretty cool. I mean, you're watching different rules, different format, but what's that event like for you as a coach to go watch that?
Well, we do a lot of 3-on-3 in practice because it's a great way to teach the game. You can't hide. there's a lot of court for three people to cover, and so if you can't play, you get exposed. But you're talking to a guy that for 14 years coached at Gonzaga, and I'm sure you've heard of the Hoop Fest 3-on-3 tournament. It's like a holiday up there. And so I've really learned to appreciate 3-on-3. the two American teams, both the men and women, have really struggled because I don't think our country has embraced three-on-three like they have in certainly in Europe. You know, there's a whole league right now, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger sport, a lot like what beach volleyball did. You know, it kind of has exploded a little bit. And I think three-on-three needs to do that in America as it has in the rest of the world.
How does the skill set, or if you're putting together a three-on-three team, how does that change from five-on-five?
Well, you know, I watched the Lithuanian men's team, and I think they took the silver in the last Olympics. But what they do is they switch every screen. You know, versatility, I think, is really important. You don't want to just get one big center put down by the basket because they've got to cover the court. You know, three-pointers count 2 points, and, you know, two-pointers only count one. And so there's a real premium on outside shooting. And what made them really good as I watched them was they could all shoot it. They all had size. And they could just switch defensively, and there were no real mismatches. So, yeah, you know, you spread the court. You can run a lot of quick sets. You know, you only have 12 seconds, though, John. So as soon as the basket goes in and you touch the ball, you have to dribble it out to the three-point line or pass it out to the three-point line. And there's only a 12-second shot clock. So it moves quick. And I like to do it, and I know other coaches like to do it in practice because it's great conditioner as well. And, you know, and people probably don't know this, but at Oregon, we won 2 national championships in 3-on-3 when Sabrina and that crew was there. So, you know, it's something that's part of our program. And I enjoyed it. It's a great day.
I've covered 5 Olympics. I'm obviously not there for this one. But one of the cool things for me was to watch other athletes from other countries, other fans from other countries. And when you're in the stands there to look around and see, you know, 10 different flags being waved at an event. Like, have you had that feel yet? Have you been there long enough to kind of pick up the international festival feel of an Olympics?
Oh, I have. I saw that at the 3-on-3 today. And in fact, during in between games, they had a great rendition of Sweet Caroline, you know, and it's funny. That's a song that everybody in the world knows and everybody knows to go dun, 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 you know, on cue. It was kind of fun. I actually took a little video of it. I just, you know, we had dinner. One of my former players, she walked on my first year at Oregon. Marie and her fiance, we had dinner tonight in one of those big outdoor kind of beer gardens, you know, lots of people. What I loved was the kind of the national pride and spirit when during the swimming was going on some big screens outside. All the French people were just cheering and the whole bit when that Marchand, that swimmer, that yeah. great swimmer from France, you know, got the gold medal. And I'm going, this is really cool. You know, I don't know if you see that in America that much, you know, that kind of national spirit. Maybe we just win so often that we kind of get numb to it. But I was really impressed and kind of taken aback.
Yeah, and I've seen that in a number of places when, you know, in Australia, when Kathy Freeman won the 400, people in Australia were crying in the streets. I mean, it was just like they were so happy for their country. And you're right. We win, we win, we win. We take it for granted, and it becomes kind of normalized. Kelly Graves joining us from the Paris Olympics. You'll get some 5-on-5. You're going to get to see Sabrina a little bit. You have other players that are in the tournament as well. What are you looking forward to?
Oh, just the chance to see them. You know, we've all touched base, to see their families. You know, one of my old Zags, Sunny Greinacher, who, by the way, your Eugene audience might remember, she was a foreign exchange student at Willamette High School in Eugene as a sophomore in high school, led them to a state championship. I continued to recruit her. You know, she's from Germany and even went to Romania to watch her in the European Championships way back when. And she's on the 3-on-3 team from Germany, and they're playing really, really well. So just a chance to see her parents. I haven't seen them in like 10 years, and that was really cool. So I'm looking forward to that tomorrow. Spain plays. So Maite Cazorla, who, you know, was our starting point guard on our Final Four team a few years ago. She is their starting point guard for Spain, and so I'll get to see her and her family. And then on Sunday, it's real. We've got Germany and the Sobley sisters against USA and Sabrina. So that'll be kind of a duck fest.
How do you root in a game like that, that Germany-USA game? How do you root?
You know what? It's funny. I'm a coach. I was sitting next to some folks today from the Netherlands, and they were kind of cheering for the German team. You know, it's, if you ever sat by coaches, even when they're not coaching, we don't cheer.
I know.
You know, we kind of analyze and watch. And so I won't outwardly be cheering for anybody other than Satu and Niar to play well and Sabrina as well. So I guess I am from USA, so, you know, I cheer for them. But I just want a great game and hope those guys play really well.
You know, you're hitting on something, too, with all the players that you've coached that are playing for other teams and the international field now of women's college basketball with so many foreign players in it. We used to say this is European style or this is American style. Is there such a thing anymore, or is basketball become an amalgam because it's an international game?
It's an international game, and God bless the 92 Dream Team. I think what they did was, you know, kind of bring basketball to the world. They saw how it can really be played, and now I think, to be honest with you, I think the Europeans do it better in a lot of ways. And you watch the NBA now, especially a lot of the coaches have a European background in the NBA, and they're taking those principles and putting it in our game. I've always been one to steal from, I love watching European men's basketball. I've been stealing their stuff offensively for a long, long time. And, yeah, I just think that, the game's being played better now than it ever has. And I think you can, kind of give them a lot of credit over here.
Now, are you going to get a croissant? Have you had a croissant? Have you had any good French food yet? What are you looking forward to?
You've seen me, right? Of course I had a croissant with extra Nutella today. And, you know, they don't do the big coffee.
I know.
Like we do.
I know.
So, man, I'm hooked on cappuccino.
I know. But you got to drink like six of them because you don't feel right as an American unless you're really indulging.
I know. Isn't that the truth? And then they put them in those cups and I can't fit my fingers through the little, you know, so then I have my pinky up. Yeah, it's not a good look for a 6'5", 250-pound guy to have his little pinky up drinking his cappuccino in a small cup.
Olympics in 2012 in London, I ordered a Coke or a Pepsi at some place, and they bring you like a small. And I said, don't you have like a big one? And the lady says, nobody needs that much soda, and walked away. So,
well, you learned a lesson, yes. Because I think she's right.
I know
she's
right.
Yeah, you go into a freaking 7-Eleven, you get a 64-ounce big gulp. I mean, honestly, who needs that? But no, the people here are really nice, and I've had a wonderful time and actually got recognized a couple of times as I was walking through the plaza, and a couple of coaches that I didn't know, hey, coach, and came up and said hello, and that's kind of cool.
I love that.
So, yeah.
I love that. Will you see stuff besides basketball? Because one of the things that surprised me was, like, you know, you go watch handball or you go watch ping pong or you watch synchronized diving, and suddenly you go, like, competition is competition. It's all really inspiring and cool.
Isn't that the truth? And no, I unfortunately won't. But you know who you need to talk to? My director of basketball operations, Brielle Mosley. She's married to Rob Mosley. They're both here, and they've been here for about a week ever since it started. And they're doing that. They've been to beach volleyball. I think they've been to handball. They're going to track. They've done, obviously, some basketball. So, you know, Rob, I know you know Rob.
Yeah.
He might be worth a call because they're really into it, and they're having a blast, as they should.
That's so cool.
So, yeah, they're experiencing the whole thing. Not me. I'm pretty much going to do the basketball and support my former players and then head back home, man. This heat and humidity is too much for me, big guy. You know how it is for us bald guys.
Yeah. You got to make sure you're hydrating.
For some reason, the sweat just comes off, you know?
Make sure you're hydrating.
Can
you turn this into a recruiting trip? I mean, is that visibility? Is your players being there, Sabrina, the Sabalis? You know, you've got fingerprints all over this tournament and this event. So can it be a little bit of a recruiting thing for Oregon basketball?
No question. Every recruit that we're recruiting in the 25 and 26 class, they know I'm here. They know why I'm here, how many players we have. I'm not sure there's another coach that actually has more players that have played for them that are actually here. which is cool. And I've made several phone calls from here already, you know, just to let them know where I'm at and what I'm doing. And I think it's been a big hit. I think our, you know, those recruits really appreciate it, and they think it's kind of cool.
Love that.
I did get dumped by one recruit though today, so that wasn't real good.
Well, you got it.
But that's just part of the business.
Part of that. You don't take that personally though, do you? I mean,
Heavens no. You know, you recruit in any given class, you know, maybe 25 or 30 kids, and you only sign two or three. Yeah, you get told no a lot, and I always tell our recruits, you know, no is the second best answer we can get. Because it's those that kind of just drag it on. They're not really interested, but they haven't eliminated you yet. So you end up spending a lot of time and oftentimes money on that recruit. So I always say, hey, listen, no's the second best answer we can get. If we're not an option for you, you know, let us know.
So love to catch up with you and download on this maybe next week or whenever. Whatever works for your schedule, your day and your pace of your day over there. But really cool to get a little flavor of the Olympics. Make sure you have some fun. I think it's special. You know it's special. And, you know, I think the basketball angle here with Oregon basketball players all over this thing is really cool. And I know my kids were watching Sabrina last night and pointing at the TV and going, hey, they know her. They've seen her before. So really cool for them.
Yeah. Yeah, the most annoying thing though is my TV remote hasn't worked in the in my room here in the hotel. but then there's no English speaking stations anyway.
I know.
So I don't know, you know, why it matters, but it's just neat to be back here in Paris, you know, on an maybe interesting or not sidelight. The last time I was here was back in 97. And we were actually, I had a basketball team here. We did our international tour, and we were actually here the night that Princess Diana was killed.
Oh, wow.
We were here that very night right here in Paris. And so that was, that's kind of unique.
Kelly Graves, keep up the fight. Thank you for checking in with us. Get some sleep tonight and get yourself a croissant in the morning.
You got it. You don't have to tell me. I'll definitely.
All right. Thanks, Coach. Appreciate it.
All right, buddy.
Us. There goes Kelly Graves, University of Oregon women's basketball coach. He is in Paris at the Olympics. Recorded that interview a little bit earlier today with Kelly Graves. I hope he is asleep by now. We'll try to catch up with him next week. I want you to leave it here. The 5 at 5 coming up later. Looks like Anna's going to try to make it 2 days in a row. How will she do? Yesterday, I thought she was a little off, a little foggy. She's dealing with some concussion symptoms. Don't at me telling me that this is cruel and unusual, what we're doing, having her do the 5 at 5. She wants to do the 5 at 5, and, you know, we'll see how she sounds. If she can't go, we'll shut her down. Leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth.
Hey, you. You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
A little bit of Pac-12 news today. I wrote about Teresa Gold, the commissioner of the Pac-12. If you are subscribed to johncanzano.com, whether you have a free subscription or a paid subscription, you got that delivered to your email inbox in real time. Pac-12 not sitting on its hands. And I think that is part of the reason that the news leaked today, that the Pac-12 is in contact with the Power Four conferences and the Mountain West Conference and others regarding scheduling alliances and partnerships. And I think the reason it leaked was in part because it's August 2nd. And I think the Pac-12 did not want the perception that it was sitting around, sitting on its hands. But think about this. If the ACC has a problem with Florida State and Clemson leaving, the Pac-12 would be the likely fallback addition. It really would. The windows would become more valuable all of a sudden. But I kind of wonder, in addition to the Pac-12, if San Diego State, Colorado State, maybe some others would be attractive to the ACC. I don't think it extends to Boise State, Fresno State, you know, some of the other Mountain West schools. Not all the Mountain West schools are equal. Like most conferences, there's a top and a bottom. But I think, like, you know, one or two at the top, San Diego State, Colorado State, maybe, or San Diego State, UNLV, maybe, might be attractive to the ACC as well. If you're going to lose two, you add four. I don't know. Maybe that helps you save face. Maybe that helps you right the ship. Regardless of this, I do think there's a chance that the Pac-12 is positioning itself to play some games in the future against Power Four conference peers. It's a very interesting strategy by Teresa Gold, the commissioner of the Pac-12. She is a fighter. And the story goes, you know, when she was a kid and growing up in a small farm town in Iowa, that there was no softball league. She wanted to play softball, damn it. And the Little League didn't offer softball. Not enough kids. And Teresa Gold said, well, either you offer softball and I'll put a team together, or you let me play baseball. And the kids of her graduating class will tell you that she was a hell of a third baseman. That's how that went. So Teresa Gold on duty, fighting. Nice to see a commissioner do what a commissioner is supposed to do, which is advocate and fight for your members. The 5 at 5 is coming up. Anna's going to join us. Second straight day. Hoping she's got her wits about her today. Yesterday, she was a little slow. But we slowed down for her. Will she keep up? We will find out here in moments.
Hey, it's John Canzano.
B-F-F-T. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Kind of a weird moment at the Olympics the other night in fencing. I don't know if you saw this, Stephen, but there was an injury in fencing. And it was a female fencer who was injured and then was sort of upset and down on the, I don't know what you call it, the mat or the floor. And her trainer came out, and her coach came out, and then somebody brought a chair over for her. She's from Brazil. And so one of the Olympic people brought a chair over and tapped the trainer on the back, and then the trainer saw the chair and then sat down in the chair. Sat down in the chair. Instead of letting the injured athlete sit in the chair, then he went, oh crap, that wasn't for me, and he quickly got up. Anna, have you seen this video?
Yeah, I mean, I have kind of a different take on it. Do you think that he sat in the chair and then was expecting her to, like, sit in his lap and,
no,
like, cradle her?
He sat in the chair thinking the chair was pulled out for him. I think it was a moment of narcissism and selfishness that he didn't realize that she's down on the ground, Olympic person's bringing a chair over, and he sees a chair and he's like, that's for me.
I'd like to think that as her trainer, maybe...
No.
Maybe he was testing the chair to make sure it was stable for her to sit in.
Can you imagine how many times he's going to think about that moment in the rest of his life?
Everything's under a microscope.
He is not a gentleman in that moment.
You think?
It's not a good look for him.
Okay.
It's not a good look. Pulling a chair out.
But he's on her team. Like, he's there to support her.
Yeah, but he's supposed to be tending to her. She's right down on the ground, and someone brings a chair out, and he sees the chair and goes, oh, that's for me. You know what I mean? Just super selfish. Steven, have you seen this video?
Yeah, I'm watching it right now. I think it was an honest mistake. I just don't think they were thinking at that moment. Like, they're not, I don't want to call them selfish, because I don't think that they purposely meant to say, hey, yeah, I'm stealing this chair.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a bad, no awareness going on right there.
Well, yeah. Okay.
No.
Because the volunteer guy, because there's, you know, a gajillion volunteers at these Olympics, God bless them, right? He taps the trainer on the shoulder and says, hey, there's a chair here. So I think it's like instant, like, reflex is that he sits in the chair. And then the volunteer taps him again and clearly is like, dude, it's not for you. It's for her. And then he gets up. Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Well,
there you have it.
Well. What are you going
to
do?
Kind of a boss move, though, if he meant to.
Have you seen, speaking of Olympic volunteers, have you seen the one volunteer guy whose job it was to retrieve a cap from the bottom of the Olympic swimming pool.
Yeah.
He's like in this really colorful Speedo.
Jumps in.
And there's no mistaking, like, he's clearly not an Olympic athlete, but he's been tasked with the job of getting into the pool and to retrieve a cap that one of the athletes has, you know, misplaced, has lost. And it's quite a moment because he really kind of sashays down and makes a show of it, and the crowd is cheering. It's like he's on a catwalk and then jumps into the water to get this cap.
How about the...
It's very
the,
zesty.
How about the fact...
Zesty.
Stephen, like have you seen that at the Olympic pool, they have a lifeguard on duty during the swimming events?
Yeah, talk about stealing money. If you're getting paid for that, how do I get that job?
Well, that's pretty good. I like that. Case you need help. But I understand why. I mean, there could be a serious medical incident that happens.
And there was.
But, you know, I just think like 30 people would be diving into the pool if there was a serious medical incident, you know?
Between trainers, that's a liability thing,
coaches,
right?
Trainers.
The memes of the lifeguards are pretty funny, though, because it's like, you know, if you think your job's easy, take a look at the lifeguard at an Olympic swimming event.
Yep. Well, there you have it.
It's good.
Well, there you go. I got a little bit of breaking news from the CW, on the CW front.
What's going on?
A source is telling me, Chase Daniel, who was supposed to be a booth analyst for the Pac-12 games on the CW, Chase Daniel will not be in the booth. So he is out there. I think, I'm not sure why he's out, but he will not be on the booth. Who should they sub in for him as an analyst on the Pac-12 games? Immediately I go to like Nick Aliotti, Ryan Leaf. I would put one of those two guys in there. Steven, Chase Daniel is going to be out. I'm about to tweet it, but you heard it here first.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the announcers they got, you know, they got Tom Brenneman. I thought that was a very interesting hire that they brought in. I think they can get somebody good, but you got to have someone with some Northwest ties. I think that's important.
Who should they sub in? You tell me on Twitter. I'm about to tweet it out. You know first because you're here. So in the meantime, Anna, are you ready? How's your head feeling?
Better than yesterday. It's day by day.
Well.
Yeah, I'm good.
Well,
you know, Nick Aliotti would be good. Does he want to do that job is the question. You know?
I don't know if he wants to.
Well,
Ryan Leaf would be my pick.
Okay.
My first pick. Because, you know, Washington State guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's got experience there. I'd like to see him in there, but. So it'll be Ted Robinson's crew. Ted Robinson will be the play-by-play guy, and Chase Daniel is supposed to be the analyst. And that is a change in plan.
Okay.
So we'll see. Who should take his place? I'm tweeting it right now. There it is. There it is. It's out there. Okay? I've hit it. It's out there. I've tweeted. Now you can have at it. At John Canzano BFT on Twitter. Okay, Anna's going to do the 5 at 5. Here we go.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, speaking of medical events at Olympic swimming, heats, the women's 200 meter individual medley qualifying heats saw Slovakian swimmer Tamara Patoka collapse poolside. She suffered an asthma attack. She's 21 years old, first time Olympian, required immediate medical attention. She was finishing 7th in the 3rd heat at the arena today when staffers had to put her on a stretcher with a neck brace and an oxygen mask. It's pretty quiet in the arena. She's now being monitored and receiving oxygen and meds. She does have asthma, and her team said that this combination of nervous and physical tension while not having her inhaler contributed to this problem.
That's, I mean, it's always scary. I mean, I immediately go to athletes who have collapsed and died in the course of competing. I think about Len Bias. I think about Hank Gathers. You know, we have seen this in basketball probably more than anywhere else. But I didn't see the scene. How disturbing was the scene, or how was it played up or played down?
Well, people who were in the arena said that it was really scary. The whole arena went silent, and the whole thing, you know, the atmosphere was very serious. So, I mean, you can imagine anybody that's seen that play out. It's alarming.
Yeah, scary stuff. And
the update is that she's okay. She's alert and awake. And, you know, she has missed the cut, but she's been conscious and been communicating with doctors.
Yeah, she's alive.
Yeah.
It's a win. You know, good for her. I'm glad she's okay. We didn't have to have, like, a intervention, though, like somebody jumping in the pool or somebody jumping
on.
Yeah, okay. So the lifeguard was like, I was ready.
Still was not called into action.
I was so ready. The lifeguard was napping with a Ernest Hemingway book laying across his chest when he was awakened by the disturbance poolside.
It's like you've got the lifeguard in an Olympic swimming event, and then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the lifeguard at the Great Wolf Lodge up in Centralia, Washington.
Super diligent.
Who has probably one of the hardest jobs.
Just blowing the whistle, a little whistle happy, though, those lifeguards.
That's okay.
A little whistle happy. Move it on.
Number two.
All right, let's stay with the Olympics and medical conditions, I guess. Olympic star Tyler Mislichuk, he's the Canadian who has gotten quite a bit of attention for vomiting 10 times after the triathlon on Wednesday. Now, I know we've talked a lot about the Seine River and how polluted it is with E. coli and other contaminants, but he's saying that he spilled his guts because of the weather conditions and not because of the water itself. He's claiming he's not used to such blazing hot weather. He's from Winnipeg, where it's, you know, cold. He trains in freezing temperatures, not the low 80s. So he says, at least, that it wasn't the river for him.
First swimmer in history to say the water's too warm. You know, our kids are like, it's so cold. I'm like, you know, you don't know cold. The polar plunge. But he got, like, he got out of the pool, out of the water, I guess pool, out of the river.
Yeah.
And immediately vomited. And then quit the competition.
He vomited, like, 10 times after, like, 10 times. He's going viral for the amount of puking that he did.
Viral vomiting. I saw a video the other day of a pitcher in baseball who was delivering a pitch while vomiting.
Ooh.
Pretty impressive.
Ooh.
Pretty distracting if you're the hitter.
Wow. Yeah.
Think about it. Think about it. Wait a minute. What's happening? I'm supposed to hit. What am I hitting here? Gives new meaning to the term spitball.
Number three.
Okay, let's go away from the Olympics momentarily. Let's talk about Skip Bayless confirming that he is leaving his show, Undisputed. He's been on there for 8 years. He's actually leaving his longtime home with FS1 and confirms that he's now seeking work elsewhere. There were rumors of this for weeks, but he has gone on the record now stating that he is in fact out at the network. He said, today was my last show on Undisputed. I'm leaving FS1. I've been planning to pursue other opportunities for several
months. No, Skip. It's time to go home.
What do you mean?
All right, I'm going to sound ageist here.
Go home?
I'm going to sound ageist.
Okay.
He's 72.
Okay.
He's 72.
So?
He's done a nice job, you know, with probably some help looking younger. Okay?
Okay.
He's made a ton of money. He's had a great career. It's time for him to go home. He can pop up here and there, host this or that, but he doesn't need to be working every day, and he doesn't need to be go be Skip. Now, I have often said there are two Skip Baylesses. There's the Skip Bayless that you see on TV, and there's Skip Bayless that I sat by as a coworker at the San Jose Mercury News. He was a columnist there. I was a columnist there. I sat beside him at games. He's a different person off air than he is on air. And I have always aspired to kind of be the same jackass on air that I am off air.
Yeah, I can confirm that you are.
Yeah, you are.
My good friend Jeff Waller told me the other day, because you're the same person off air that you are on air.
You actually are.
And I will take that as a compliment. I'm not acting here.
It's the same jackass 360.
I'm not acting. Skip is thoughtful,
yeah,
soft-spoken.
Really?
Eating sushi and drinking a Tab Cola in the press box. Brought his own. Talking about his latest 5K he's going to run.
Huh.
Giving me career advice and being kind of a thoughtful, you know, unless he was trying to get me out of his way in San Jose.
Yeah.
He was the one who told me when, you know, they offered me the job up here in the Pacific Northwest. He said, take it. Mm. He said, there's nobody up there. They need a voice up there. You can give them a voice. He said, you should go there. He said, this Bay Area thing, there's like five or six of us here. This is no good for you.
Interesting.
He said, go take that job and don't look back. And he was right. He was right about that. Unless he was just trying to get me away. Maybe he wanted my seat, my parking space or something. But it's time for Skip to go home. He's 72.
He's not ready.
Go home.
He explicitly stated he is ready for the next chapter.
What's so wrong at home that he has to be working all the time?
That's kind of a leap.
Well, he just made like $7 million a year. I'm sure he can make a ton of money and just, you know, do that act a couple times a week.
Go write a book. Another one. It's just, but you're 72, like this, you know, I'll tell you this. I won't be that guy at 72. I will not be hosting this show at 72.
I thought you were doing it until the day you die.
Gumming my way through this. I will not be at a press box.
Gumming your way through.
I will not be at a press box. I will not be at a press box picking lettuce out of my teeth. I will not be like in a hotel room. My goal is to not die in a hotel room.
Yeah, good goal.
Seems kind of like, you know, when I heard Bob Saget slipped and hit his head, I was like, nope, not going out that way. Jeez. That happens to people when they get older and they don't want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
You find them passing in weird places.
Do you think it's one of those things where it's like he can't quite let go because Skip Bayless, the on-air person, you know, it's like he's lost himself in that identity.
Yes, I 100% think so. And I you know, I don't think he would take offense to this. May his soul rest in peace. But I had
he's not dead.
No, I'm talking about someone else. Oh. I'm about to bring up someone else.
He's just,
he just retired.
He's not even retired.
Not even doing that.
He's just leaving.
I'm talking about Bill Shonley.
Okay.
Okay, I had that conversation with Bill Shonley. I said, I told him one time, I think Bill Shonley died like years before the Shons passed away. The Shons was his persona. Bill Shonley was the person. And I said, you know, that Bill Shonley died in his 50s probably.
How did he take that? What did he say?
He loved being the Shons.
Yeah.
And that was the conversation we had. And I said, I think you like being that guy. He liked being at the games. He got energized by it. He got energized taking photos with people and, you know, showing people the championship ring and saying Rip City. And people loved him for that. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but you lose your identity. You become this alter ego. And, yeah, I think part of Skip probably is that way, that he doesn't know what to do with himself. So much, too. And this isn't unique to, like, people that are in the media or celebrities.
No, it's not. Yeah.
So much, and in particular men, I'm calling men out here. We attach so much of our identity to our jobs. You know, it's a conversation Alex Molden and I have had a bunch of times. He's out of the NFL as a young man, and he doesn't know what to do with himself because he's always been a football player. And he realizes, oh, I'm not a football player anymore. I'm just Alex. And so that is something Skip needs to be okay with, if that's his real name. You know what I mean? You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that. Because it's the people who are in their 60s and 70s, and maybe they're running a company, or they helped found it, and they just can't quite let it go, you know?
Skip's real name is John, by
it
the way.
Is?
I just saw that, yeah, I was going to tell you guys.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's a junior.
John Bayless Jr.?
John Edward Bayless.
John Edward?
Yeah.
He's not even a junior. He's the second.
But his dad, so they called him Skip. He caused a lot of problems. He caused a lot of problems on that staff in San Jose. You know why? We had egos there. It was me, Skip.
So
it was Tim Kawakami. It was Mark Purdy. It was Ann Killian.
Oh, wow.
Okay, and then Bud Geraci, who might have been the most talented of all, but he had almost the opposite of an ego.
Yeah, God bless whoever was managing all you guys.
Happy to be behind the scenes. And And so they would go like, it would go like this. Hey, Raider Niner game coming up Saturday. Skip gets the best parking pass. And Purdy and Killian are mad about it.
Right.
Kawakami's like just over it. Because that's him.
Right.
And I'm like the newer guy. And I'm just happy to be like at the game. And I'm seeing all the squabbling. And there's just a lot of, why does Skip get the best seat? Why does he get the parking pass? You know, where, what lot did you park in? What's, you know, it's like of that going on.
But if you have five columnists covering one game,
it was a mistake.
That's,
but the, but they had the right formula. The paper had the right formula because they said that commentary and opinion is what people want.
Sure.
We're not going to have a beat reporter and a sidebar. Instead, we're going to have five columnists. They said the starting five. That's what they called it. And they put five columns on the cover of their sports section every Sunday morning and every Monday. Like, it was the five columnists all writing. It was a lot of noise.
Yeah.
I think you'd be okay with three.
Yeah.
It should have been, like, the starting three. But that doesn't have a ring to it.
Number four.
Probably more than people wanted.
Yeah, probably, but that's okay. Baylor football. Okay, so yesterday I talked about how Coach Deion Sanders has his players putting their Instagram handles right on their practice jerseys, like at Shedeur Sanders, whatever. Yes. Baylor, Baylor's football coaches are getting some attention with their practice t-shirts. They have not been shy. Like, the program itself has not been shy about the fact that they're paying players and that Baylor benefits from the new landscape of college football. Head coach Matt Aranda said last month that, hey,
Isn't it Dave Aranda over at Baylor?
Yeah. Dave Aranda.
Concussion symptoms, guys.
It says, we're paying players. And so now the coaches at practice are wearing shirts that say, we pay players in big yellow Baylor letters.
That's funny.
It's just going right for it.
I love it. Lean into it.
Lean in.
If you're Baylor. I'm just glad that's what they're known for right now instead of what they used to be known for, which was like 40 violent crimes a season. I'm trying to be nice.
Well, that's, that's just the football team, too. You forgot about the basketball team.
Yeah, it was... Baylor has had some worse days than this one. So I like that they're leaning into it. You know, it's like Dana Altman said on this show. He says, it used to be the worst thing anyone could accuse you of, paying players. Now you got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Number five.
All right. Paris, the city of love. Chinese badminton player Huang Yajong not only got a gold medal at the Olympics, she had her fiance, her boyfriend, propose to her on live television. So she had just beaten South Korea in the badminton doubles contest. It's the Adidas Arena, by the way, in Paris. And then her boyfriend strolls up and says, I love you forever. Will you marry me? Gets down on one knee. Yes, I do.
It's a lot, man. It's a lot.
Wait, so she won gold?
Won gold.
What if she got silver? Does he still propose?
We don't. We'll never know.
Never know.
That's why I think it's a bad move by him.
Why?
It's not his moment.
It's not. Yeah, I agree.
It should have been. He should have allowed her to have that moment and let it stand alone. Propose later. If he had won the medal, he has the right to reign on his own moment. But he kind of... He stole her moment.
If she won silver... There's no chance he's proposing. No chance. Because she just lost.
You don't know that.
Tennis? She just lost a head-to-head match. Maybe then you're going to propose? No way. She's going to be mad.
Maybe he doesn't get on a knee if she wins silver. He stands when he does it. I don't know.
By the way, he is also a badminton star for Team China. So they're all badminton players.
I don't like this. I think he should have let her have her moment. If he wins gold and he proposes like the Boise State football player did after the Statue of Liberty play all those years ago, then it's okay because it's your moment and you're going, hey, I want to share this with you. But this was her moment, Anna. Let her have her moment.
I really didn't think there was anything critical to be said about
this. Well, because you're, I gotta say it because you're a woman.
Oh.
My only criticism.
You can't see it from a man's perspective.
My only criticism, except you're trying to speak on the woman's behalf.
Because I can see how selfish that is, and I have daughters, and I'll tell you this: like, if one of our three daughters goes to the Olympics someday,
yeah, okay,
and wins a gold medal,
okay, let me,
and
that.
Some yahoo jumps out of the crowd and proposes to her that she's been dating, I'm gonna be like, dude, read the room. She's having her Olympic moment. Now you want to make it about your wedding.
The proposal isn't even about the man either. It's not about you.
It's not about you.
But, I mean, I do think it's partially about...
Go do that somewhere else later. If he does it even after the venue later. Because this is... isn't it enough that she won a gold medal? Like, he has to be like, let's make it even better. And then what is he going to do? Is he going to do like a gender reveal thing, like, you know?
Now maybe he was worried that she would say no, because there's no chance she says no in that moment.
She's so much fresh.
She wins the gold. It's like, nah, I'm good. I don't want to marry you.
My criticism of this is just generically that a public proposal, really, that bothers me.
Okay.
Well, that's just so much pressure on the woman to say yes and not disappoint you're having to factor in the audience that is watching and everything that doesn't really have to do with, like, the person who's proposing to you and your own potential future with them.
He needed a friend to tell him,
this is a
bad idea. Do not do this. You're going to look like you're raining on her parade. Meet with her later. Take her somewhere later. Go on one of those romantic bridges in Paris and get down on a knee in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Maybe it's the Chinese government orchestrating this because they want the good PR for China.
And he's badminton and she's badminton?
They're both badminton.
So maybe they would be okay with this.
I'm saying, there's like, you know, the government
all the way
in China
to the
is
top.
Going, yeah. Like, they're saying, hey, we need more positive publicity. We're behind in the medal count, so we need a little good PR here.
Yeah, bad idea. Don't you think it was better that I proposed to you privately?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, nobody was around.
Yeah, I would have really not liked a public proposal.
Those fake ones, like, you know, every time I see one in an arena, I think it's fake.
Yeah.
Because it's like, who would do that?
Well, some people do.
Steven, where did you propose?
The Blazer game. No.
Blazer game.
200 level.
After a chalupa.
He's playing for 200 level tickets.
You know what? Once we got the 100 points, got the free chalupa, took her to Taco Bell, did it there. No.
He was so fired up.
I did it just at our house. When we rented our house, I was like, hey, I need to see you for a second. And then did it.
That was what you said?
Yeah.
Is that like a common phrase you use? Like if there's a leak in the bathroom
or
big spider?
Well, that too. I mean, if it's got to be fixed, Coach Vaughn's going to fix it. But I was working with the Blazers at the time. And so she even told me, she said, I thought you were just going to show me some play that you were watching and like scouting. And I was like, no. And then I proposed to her.
Oh, that's a good surprise.
Did you get down on a knee?
I did. I got nervous though. And so I hugged her first just out of nowhere. Just like randomly hugged it because I was so nervous. And then I just got on my knee and then,
I got nervous too.
That's so cute.
I had thought through all the things except the actual proposal part. And so I was very careful. We were on a beach and I, was very careful. And then I kind of lost my mind in that last minute and I was going to write on the sand, will you marry me, when she wasn't looking. And then I was going to turn her around and have her see it. Well, I started to write it while she was looking at me.
That's a lot to write. That's a lot to write and a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I hadn't thought it through.
Yeah.
Misspell a word or something?
Just keep it simple, guys. It's like these, like, again, I'm going to reference these stupid gender reveal things that people do where they're flying planes and shooting off balloons and popping things. And, you know, there's so much that goes wrong. I read a story about a couple that was doing one of these gender reveal things. They were flying a plane overhead. And they were going to have pink smoke or blue smoke come out of the plane, Stephen. The plane malfunctioned, and the plane crashed into the people that were down on the ground, wiping out like half of their family.
Well,
let's not do that.
Did you see, maybe it was in the diving, but they did a gender reveal after the guy, like, finished his little thing. Like, the wife said, it's a boy or whatever. It had, like, a sign that she just held up.
Wait, this was an Olympic thing?
Yeah, this just happened. Wow. Like his wife had a sign and just, like, held it up and said, it's a boy. And then
I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
because it's not him winning a gold medal. It's just... like, hey, by the way,
it's not a marriage, it's gender reveal.
This
is
totally different. It's different because this is something we are sharing. We have your son is here in a way. He's here. It's your Olympic moment. And by the way, she didn't do it like when he was mid dive. You know, hey.
Well, the difference is you're right. It takes away from her moment. Like, she won. It should be about her. He jumped in and on her press
on that moment. Anna, let's just. Suppose you're an Olympic champion in some event. I am so overjoyed for you, and I'm just beaming with joy for you. My initial impulse is not like, how can I seize this moment and hijack it?
I never even thought about it that way until you guys brought this up.
Let's go to the phones. Sam in Portland. Sam, help us out.
I can't even believe it. It's the most terrible thing I've heard about in the Olympics. I don't know what's worse, that or the guy who stole the seat. But yeah, it's totally her moment. She worked her entire career for that moment to win the gold, and he's totally stolen from her. Jerk move, terrible. And you should have a poll. Who's worse, that or taking the chair?
Yeah, I'd say that. And you know what else I would tell her? Guess what? This is your life. This guy is going to, every time you accomplish something, he's going to come out of nowhere to be like, hey, look at me.
Well, that's like, Anna, if you were to win like an Emmy, John goes up when you're accepting your reward. And John's like, hey, will you marry me? Like, right
there. I like to thank all the people that helped me help her.
Hey, John, why are you coming up here?
Like, that's ridiculous.
If these badminton players, if they actually do get married, which apparently might be in question according to you guys, they wind up having a baby. The moment the umbilical cord is cut, he poses for a selfie with the baby, just him and the baby.
Yeah, that's right. Then we know. This is your life, lady. I don't know. She said yes?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
A lot of people looking at her. We'll see. Yeah. I would vote against that marriage
We need to get her on the show and talk some sense into her.
All right, Anna, thank you. We're a lot sharper today.
Thanks.
You're coming back.
Doing my best.
Appreciate that. All right, leave it here. You got the BFT.
Hey, it's...
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Daniel will not serve as a booth analyst for Pac-12 games on the CW. Sources telling me. Change in plan. Daniel's out. Who should take his place? I think Ryan Leaf should take his place. That's just me. I've got a bunch to get to here in this segment. I want to also mention, by the way, on the 3-on-3 basketball, Stephen, we were talking about this earlier. Part of the issue with 3-on-3 basketball is the requirements. You know, Team USA got an automatic bid into 3-on-3 basketball. But the only way to acquire, for a player to acquire ranking points in 3-on-3 basketball is to participate in a FIBA-sanctioned 3-on-3 competition. So those events started in March, and the Olympic qualifying tournament was in May, which means it's impossible to be a 3-on-3 player if you're an NBA player. So that's why you have players like Jimmer Fredette, who last played in 2019, on the team. Should that be removed? Like, wouldn't it be better if the 3-on-3 thing was like Steph Curry, LeBron, Kevin Durant?
It would. It would definitely get more eyeballs. Like, you could even take the top three guys that didn't make Team USA, you know, Jalen Brunson, Jaylen Brown, and then throw someone else out there, and that's going to be a gold-winning team.
There's an issue there. Why are they doing that? They want to keep the sanctity of their FIBA, you know, qualification for sure.
I feel like they kind of want to. Yeah, they want to keep the two sports separate because they are different sports. Like, you know, Kelly Graves even was talking about that, how it's a completely different game 3-on-3 than it is 5-on-5. I mean, it's the same sport of basketball, but the game is completely different. So I think they're kind of trying to keep those separate, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. More news today. Portland State ready to look for their next athletic director. They have officially posted the job and posted the opening of athletic director. Now, Portland State needs to hire somebody who knows the challenges that Portland State faces. They need to hire somebody who knows the marketplace. They need to hire somebody who understands fundraising in this state. And I think it's why, as I look at what Portland State's going to do, I'm relieved a little bit that they're not going to go with a national search firm. I think I know who they should hire. I think Mark Masseri, the former deputy AD at Oregon State and former athletic director at UC Santa Barbara, he lives in the area, he works in the area, he's still involved in college athletics. I don't know if he'd want it. But a guy like that who knows the region, or one of the deputies at Oregon or Oregon State, is a better fit for me than going out and finding somebody who doesn't know the challenges of Portland State. It's a different job. It's tricky. You have to know the job. And I think it was part of the problem with John Johnson, who they brought in. I wasn't wild about that hire. And I think people know that because you didn't often hear John Johnson on this show. And I just think he was not a good fit. He's not a bad person. He just wasn't a good fit. You need somebody that is going to help the basketball programs, is going to help that football program, who understands the complexity of raising money and being a player here in the Portland market. And that is a tricky, tricky job. It's a high wire act. Meanwhile, UCLA and USC and Oregon and Washington all into the Big Ten Conference. All those ADs out talking. Martin Jarmon, the athletic director at UCLA, telling the LA Times that they have set aside $10 million a year for student-athlete support, for chartered flights, meals, exams, to help with exams and class times. And it's just a bunch of money they're spending to help with kind of the support of going to the Big Ten. Well, I'm just curious if that will be sustainable for a school that will not compete at the top of that conference in football. Keep an eye on that. Meanwhile, Notre Dame's athletic director telling The Athletic that they feel stronger about their place as an independent than they ever have. The athletic director now at Notre Dame is Pete Bavacqua. And the former AD, Jack Swarbrick, also talking, saying that they view that Notre Dame as an independent, needs to stay independent. They have a relationship with the ACC, of course. But they're watching what's going on with Florida State and Clemson, and they're going, hey, thank goodness we're not all in on the ACC. Moving on beyond that, you have Kentucky. Kentucky had some problems with impermissible benefits that occurred with football rules. This happened with 11 football student-athletes between the spring of 21 and March of 22. 11 athletes were paid, but did not perform work that they were said to be doing. Of course, this is a moot subject now with NIL, and Kentucky has reached an agreement with the NCAA on this. And the agreement is, A, it's not a rule violation anymore. So they are accepting 2 years of probation and a fine. But it's just further evidence that, like, some of these schools were doing this long before it was permissible, and we all know that. So there you go. A bunch of news going on. We'll close today with some parting thoughts coming up. I hope you're here for it, and I'll take your phone calls. What's on your mind this Friday? Oregon, Washington, USC, UCLA in the Big Ten. How did it feel today for you as a Duck fan officially, or how did it feel as an Oregon State fan officially as you watched it unfold? I want your phone calls wherever you're listening to this show. 503-417-7575.
Hey, y'all. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I want your phone calls. I want your fine phone calls in this final segment as we look toward a beautiful weekend here in the Pacific Northwest. What's on your mind as it pertains to Oregon, Washington, USC, UCLA, Oregon State, Washington State, the Olympics, paying players? What's on your mind? 503-417-7575. Your phone calls will drive the end of the show today. Cam is in Eugene, of course, listening on Fox Sports Eugene. Cam, go ahead.
Hey, John. Hey, Anna, everybody. Happy Friday. Real quick, I proposed to my wife with the old ring and the wine glass trick. Unfortunately, she was in on the computer checking her email after just getting off work, and I could not get her out of that room to propose to her. It took like 15 minutes to the point where I almost snapped at her. And it was a funny story when it was all said and done. But real quick, it's kind of weird, but Oregon State fans should probably say thank you that Phil Knight's opening up his wallet this wide. It's a bit of a weird thing to propose, but Nick Saban didn't retire because NIL came along. He retired because suddenly everybody could pay players, and it wasn't unique anymore and special and their advantage. And the reality is they love that scheme. They like to keep it to themselves. They like to benefit from it. And it was going to take somebody west of the Mississippi, where traditionally the father is the son under the rules, spending too much before anything was going to be done to regulate NIL. But now that Alabama's on the losing end, Ohio State's on the losing end and can't keep up with Oregon, I think reform's coming. And while it might be short-lived as a Duck fan to hold the advantage, I think it'll be good for college football overall.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, like, you know, how different maybe the retirement of Nick Saban looks when you frame it with everything that we have learned since he had made that announcement. Like, you know, I had a coach in the ACC reach out to me after Saban announced the retirement, and that coach said to me, you know, why do you think he's going? And, you know, I said, well, he probably is getting out while he's on top because, you know, here comes all the competition with name, image, likeness, and all the schools that are gonna pay players more. And he flat out said, you know, yeah, everybody's gonna be able to pay now, not just Alabama. So I think it's interesting to kind of look at that and think about Nick Saban's how different does Saban's retirement look now, Stephen? Even with a little distance, even if we knew back then. Yeah, it was probably not a good time. Like, I think he knew. Like, you know, he had to be looking around going, I don't know if I can get to the playoff anymore.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think he would have always thought he could make the playoff. I think it's just a lot more work. Like think about just five years ago in the college game as being a head coach compared to now. I think it's so much more stress worthy on your body and on your mind. And I think Nick Saban probably just was weighing it out of, kind of like you're talking about Skip Bayless, like he's just retired. I think Nick Saban just looking at him like, I don't want to put in all this work every single season, to make the playoffs and then lose in the first round if that's what's going to happen. Like, it's just not going to be worth it for me. It's not going to boost my legacy up anymore. So I might as well just call it a day while I can and go do, you know, some type of media job where I still have coherent thoughts and I still have coherent, you know, my mind is still here when it comes to football. Because if he waited too long on that, then he wouldn't want to be a media guy. But I just feel like the job is just so much harder and so much more taxing, like on your body. I mean, it's hard nowadays.
Yeah, and it's a different job. I mean, if you think about it, it's just a different job. And he was signaling that kind of all along towards the end, talking about paying players and how players had changed.
Well, I think even in game, it's more now who are your coordinators. Like, I think you're just more of a figurehead at that point because it's all about recruiting, and those players are going to, you know, commit to the coordinators, and they're going to play under their calls.
And people who don't know, I mean, you look at Phil Knight, whose net worth is above $30 billion, okay? You know, 30, 34, 35 billion, whatever that number is. You know, the fortune that Oregon has to have a donor who is capable of investing $1 billion in what Oregon wants to be from an athletic standpoint is obviously a fortunate position to be in. But I have heard people talk about, for example, T. Boone Pickens at Oklahoma State, kind of in the same breath. Now, he died 5-6 years ago, but he was being positioned as he's kind of the Phil Knight of Oklahoma State. You know, I looked into it at the time. At the time of his death, his net worth was $1.3 billion. He's not even in the same billionaire room as Phil Knight is. And T. Boone Pickens was often talked about as, well, he is like Phil Knight to Oklahoma State. But T. Boone Pickens wasn't giving $1 billion to Oklahoma State. You know, he was given tens, or if not $50 million or $100 million to Oklahoma State. He didn't do to Oklahoma State what Phil Knight did for Oregon. T. Boone Pickens, his entire donation was, you know, he donated $120 million that they got last year. Like, that's a drop in the bucket. They got that from his estate, $120 million. That's a drop in the bucket for Phil Knight in his estate. Like, they, you know, I don't know the details of it, but I am told by fundraisers at Oregon and executives and administrators at Oregon that Phil Knight has gone to great lengths to ensure that Oregon is going to have a future well beyond him. And, you know, his kids probably and his grandkids and all that. But, you know, Oregon would like to give him a return on that investment. It's not in writing anywhere. Nobody has out and out said it. Nobody is going to come out and say, if we don't win a national championship for 87-year-old Phil Knight, this is going to be a failure. But I think you have to, if you're an Oregon fan, walk into this football season going, you know, the window here, anytime you're dealing with somebody who is 87 years old, the window is narrowing. And I think Oregon is well aware of that. And you hear sort of an urgency at Oregon. So I think it's interesting to kind of track that and feel that as Oregon is having this first season in the Big Ten Conference. You just don't know how many you're going to have. Like, none of us know how many seasons we're going to have. It's one of the beauties of life. And so Phil Knight out there rooting for his team, probably happy that his team belongs and has a place in major college football for the foreseeable future. But, you know, Oregon's not in this position without him. They're stuck in the pack, whatever it would be, if there's no Phil Knight. And I think Washington, as much as the Washington fans would begrudge Phil Knight and Oregon and say, Uncle Phil, I mean, if Oregon's not in the Big Ten, is Washington in the Big Ten? Is it possible that Phil Knight has paved the way for both those schools to be into the Big Ten just by virtue of elevating Oregon's brand and investing in it? It's really worth thinking about. I want you to have a great weekend. I appreciate that you're here listening to the show. If you want to read me, johnconzano.com, that's where you find me. Steven, have a great weekend. We're back next week.
Summer is here.